Louis Armstrong and his Hot 7 opening up this afternoon's Fresh Air with a recording of the Melancholy Blues. This afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, my guest will be Robert Greene, who for 20 years was the fashion editor of Playboy magazine. He says that his biggest break in life was that he came from a broken home. In his father's family, it was called pâté. In his mother's family, it was called chopped liver. He says this taught him that if he was going to have a meaningful existence, he'd have to invent one. Well, in addition to his fashion writing and consulting, Greene is known as a designer, cook, party giver, and a frequent TV talk show guest. He lives in about four homes. One of them is located in Bucks County. At 3:30 today, Fresh Air's film reviewer Bill Van Wert will be with us to review the movie The Electric Horseman with Jane Fonda and Robert Redford. He'll also highlight some of the upcoming movies that you can see this week on television. The United States in a Revolutionary World is the theme for a lecture series sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Wilmington and the University of Delaware in Newark, Delaware. Last night, as part of this series, Dr. Howard Perlmutter of the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania gave an address on U.S. transnational corporations in a revolutionary world. In his address, Dr. Perlmutter discussed the changes and difficulties that transnational corporations will encounter over the next 10 years in a world of nations asserting their own national interests. We'll hear this talk at about 2:45 this afternoon on Fresh Air. Joining me now is Sonia Sanchez, poet, teacher, and playwright. Her writing of the late 60s and 70s reflects her commitment to radical black politics. Her books include Homecoming, Love Poems, and a blues book for blue black magical women. She's also the author of the play Sister Sanji, which was produced by Joseph Papp at the Public Theater in New York. She's also been a contributing editor for Black Scholar magazine and editor of We Be Word Sorcerers, 25 Stories by Black Americans. Last year, she was awarded the National Endowment of Art Award. Currently, she's an associate professor of English at Temple University, and she's a member of the Pennsylvania Council of the Arts. Sonia Sanchez is going to be one of the artists performing next week at the Afro-American Historical and Cultural Museum in a program honoring Martin Luther King. The performance will be January 15th at 8 o'clock. Also reading will be Everett Hoagland, Ricky Leitz, and Naomi Nelson. If you're interested, you're going to need a reservation, so I'd like to just give you the phone number. You could jot it down and give a call because you'll need a reservation. Seating's limited. Here's the number. It's 574-3696, 574-3696. If you missed it, I'll give that number again a little later. Sonia Sanchez, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello, how are you?
Before we get to talk, I'd really like it if you could do a short reading of your work for us.
Okay, will do. The first thing I want to read is a letter I wrote to a man by the name of Ezekiel Impahalele, who was a professor at University of Penn with me when I was there. And Zeke went home to South Africa, and when he came back, he decided to return home after 20 years of exile. And one day, my children and I spent one day with Zeke before he left, and this is the letter I wrote to him when I came home after having talked to him the entire day. You know how you talk to people, and all of a sudden you look up and it's dark, but you've talked the day away, and you've almost talked the night away, and you finally turn on lights. But there was a very serious commitment for him to go back home to South Africa after 20 years of exile. Dear Zeke, I've just left your house where you and Rebecca served a dinner of peace to me and my sons. The ride home is not as long as the way I came. 2 centuries of hunger brought me along many detours before I recognized your house. It is raining, and as I watch the raindrops spin like colored beads on the windshield, I hear your voice calling out to your ancestors to prepare a place for you were returning home, leaving the skeleton rites of 20 years behind. You and Rebecca have been walking a long time. Your feet have crossed the African continent to this western one, where you move amid leaden eyes and laughter that froze you in snow-capped memories. Your journey began in 1957, when the ruling class could not understand your yawns of freedom, the motion of a million eyes to see for themselves what life was, is, and could be. And you cut across the burial grounds of South Africa, where many of your comrades slept. And you cut across those black Africans, smiling their long smiles from diplomatic teeth. Now you are returning home. Now your mother's womb cries out to you. Now your history demands your heartbeat. and you turn your body towards the whirlwind of change, towards young black voices calling for a dignity speeding beyond control on the right side of the road. But this night, full of whispering summer trees, this night, nodding with South African faces, heard you say, "Sonia, I must be buried in my country, in my own homeland. My bones must replenish the black earth from whence they came. Our bones must fertilize the ground on which we walk, or we shall never walk as men and women in the 21st century." I talked to my sons as the car chased the long-legged rain running before us. I told them that men and women are measured by their acts, not by their swaggering speech or walk, or the money they have stashed between their legs. I talked to my sons about bravery outside of Bruce Lee grunts and jabs, outside of Star Wars nights fertilizing America's green youth into continued fantasies, while reality explodes underground in neutron boldness. I said, "You have just sat and eaten amid bravery. Relish the taste. Stir it around and around in your mouth until the quick sweetness of it becomes bitter. Then swallow it slowly, letting this new astringent taste burn the throat. Bravery is no easy taste to swallow." I said, "This man and woman we have just left this night have decided to walk like panthers in their country, to breathe again their own breath suspended by 20 years of exile, to settle in the maternal space of their birth, where there are men who shake hands without hearts waiting for them. They are a fixed portrait of courage. It is 2 a.m. My children stretch themselves in dreams, kicking away the room's shadows. I stare at the night, piling in little heaps near my bed. Zeke, maybe you are a madman, I a mad woman, to want to walk across the sea, to saddle time while singing a future note. We follow the new day's breath. We answer old bruises waiting to descend upon our heads. We answer screams creeping out of holes and shells buried by memories waiting to be cleansed. You invoking the ghost lurking inside this child woman. You breaking my curtain of silence. I love the tom-tom days you are marching, your feet rooted in the sea. Save a space for me and mine, Zeke and Rebecca, this lost woman who walks her own shadow for peace." That's a piece to Zeke when he left in 1977 to go home. A poem simply called Poem at 30. "It is midnight, no magical bewitching hour for me. I know only that I am here, waiting, remembering that once as a child I walked 2 miles in my sleep. Did I know then where I was going, traveling? I am always traveling. I want to tell you about me, about nights on a brown couch when I wrap my bones in lint and refuse to move. No one touches me anymore. Father, do not send me out among strangers. You black man, stretching, scraping the mold from your body, here is my hand. I am not afraid of the night." That's a poem that I'm reading from a book called I've Been a Woman, New and Selected Poems, which is a recent book of mine. A poem that was done, all poets, you know, will sometimes have a sense of like feeling sorry for themselves. And so they write these very kind of poems that like will say, "Hey, look at me, look what's happening to me." And the next poem summary is something like that. But it's a poem to be, it's a tongue-in-cheek kind of thing, simply called Summary. "No sleep tonight. Not even after all the red and green pills I have pumped into my stuttering self or the sweet wine that drowns them. This is a poem for the world, for the slow suicides in seclusion. Somewhere on 130th Street, a woman, frail as a child's ghost, sings, 'Oh, oh, what can the matter be? Johnny, so long at the fair. I learned how to masturbate through the New York Times. I thought, should I have thought anything that could not be proved? I thought and was wrong. Listen, fool, black bitch of fantasy. Life is no more than gents and gigolos, 99% American. Liars and killers, 199% American. Dreamers and drunks, 299% American. Only God is 300% American. I say, is everybody happy? This is a poem for me. I am alone. One night of words will not change all that." So, you know, it's a kind of poem where you're feeling sorry for yourself, and yet in all you're taking pot shots at a lot of things there. And, you know, you do that kind of poem, you move out of it, you know, you keep on going, but it's something that helps you to keep on going. A poem simply called Poem Number 8. I've been a woman. I say I've been a woman. With my legs stretched by the wind, rushing the day, thinking I heard your voice, while it was only the night moving over, making room for the dawn. That's a kind of special favorite poem of mine there, because I think a lot of women experience that. And a poem that I did for a very young woman. I was teaching a class in New York City, and she was talking about getting married at 17, which is such a peculiar age to get married, in quotes, at. No one should get married at 17 or 18 or 19 or 20 or 21 or 22, probably at 25, maybe by 30. You've gotten the career straight. You've gotten many things straight in your head. You've done all you wanted to do at that point. Yeah, 30. But her husband, after 6 months of marriage, had come home to her after having been with another woman. And she literally went out to lunch. I mean, she climbed a wall. And some of us had to go and pull her off that wall because she was not really, I mean, she didn't have the age, perhaps. Not that we all as women, you know, at any age can handle that. But at least if you're older, you can handle it much better than a 17-year-old. And this poem is for her and all women who have experienced this. Poem number 7. When he came home from her, he poured me on the bed and slid into me like glass. And there was the sound of splinters. And it's very hard to put splinters together again. I'm going to end up with two poems, two kind of special poems. One poem is a poem to a man by the name of Sterling Brown, who is a man, a poet, a black poet who's been writing many a year for a long time in a place called Washington, D.C. He taught at Howard University for quite a while, and he has what I call an enviable record of having been fired a couple of times because of the kind of person he was, his politics, and the kinds of people he brought into his classroom. He brought, like, he would teach folklore and would bring in those guys, you know, who would play real, I mean, who would tell the dozens and whatever. And, of course, many people on the university level who are very academic thought this was terrible. Of course, I do the same kind of thing, and it's really a joy. So he's sort of like one of my models, and I love him very much. And this poem is for Sterling Brown. They had a Sterling Brown Day in Washington, D.C. It's a poem I did for him. What song shall I sing you amid epidemic prophecies where holy men bleed like water over the bones of black children? How shall I call your name, sitting priest-like on mountains, raining incense, scented dancer of the sun? Where shall memory begin you? Overturning cradles, rocking cemented eyes, closed flowers, opening like eastern deities under your hand. And your words, tall as palm trees, black with spit, soothing the lacerated mind. And your words, scratching the earth, carving dialect men into pyramids, where no minstrel songs run from their thighs. Your soul, dodging loneliness and the festivals of Renaissance rhythms. Your life, skin tight with years, a world created from love. You, griot of fire, harnessing ancient warriors. Hey, hey, yeah, 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 yeah. Ayo, 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 yo, 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 da hale he boom 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 boom, da hale he boom 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 boom, da hale he boom 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 boom. You, griot of the wind, glorifying red gums, smiling tom-tom teeth. You see, Sterling took some of the old black men and women who used to sit on those porches in the South, you know, smoking the corn cob pipes and smiling red gum smiles, and made them majestic kinds of people. So this poem is for him because he took dialect people, as we called them, and made them worthy of poems and made beautiful poems about them. And so I try to celebrate Sterling because he did that kind of celebration for people who really needed it. And the last poem is a poem that I did for two very special women. My mother, who died of cancer, in 77 in a place called Detroit, Michigan, and for Shirley Graham Du Bois, who, a woman I met in a place called Amherst, and I never quite understood why I went to Amherst, but when I met Shirley Graham Du Bois, I understood fully what my whole purpose was. I met her, and she changed my entire life. Shirley Graham Du Bois was a writer, you know, in her own right. She wrote many biographies, young people, but a very political woman and a political fighter. She died in a place called the People's Republic of China of breast cancer. There are two things that you might not understand. The title is Kwa Mama Zetu Walio Tuzea, for our mothers who gave us birth, and Ola Kun, which really means goddess of the sea. Death is a 5 o'clock door, forever changing time. And it was morning without sun or shadow, a morning already afternoon, sky cloudy with incense. And it was morning, male in speech, feminine in memory. But I am speaking of everyday occurrences, of days unrolling bandages for civilized wounds, of gaudy women chanting rituals under a waterfall of stars, of men freezing their sperms in diamond-studded wounds, of children abandoned to a curfew of marble. As morning is the same as night, death and life are one, spring, settling down on you like green dust, mother. Ambushed by pain in rooms bloated with a century of cancer, your face a scattered cry from Quickquake's wooden bar, mother, I call out to you, traveling up the Congo, I am preparing a place for you. Night, made of female rain, I am ready to sing her song, prepare a place for her. She comes to you out of turquoise pain. Restring her eyes for me, restring her body for me, restring her peace for me. No longer full of pain, may she walk bright with orange smiles, may she walk as it was long ago, may she walk. Abundant with lightning steps, may she walk. Abundant with green trails, may she walk. Abundant with rainbows, may she walk as it was long ago, may she walk. At the center of death is birth. In those days when Amherst, fertilized by black myths, rerouted the Nile, you became the word, Shirley Graham Du Bois. You were the Dan's pyramidal sister. You told us in what Egypt our feet were chained. You trained in the world studio, painted the day with palaces, and before you marched the breath of our ancestors. And your laughter, passing through a village of blacks, scattered the dead faces. And your voice, lingering like a shy goat, fed our sad hungers. And I, what Pennsylvania day was I sucking dry, while you stuttering a thousand cries, hung your breasts on pagodas. And I, what dreams had I suspended above our short order lives, when death showered you with bells? Bells, 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 call her back for me, bells. Call back this memory still fresh with cactus pain. Call her name again, bells. Shirley Graham Du Bois has died in China, and her death demands a capsizing of tides. Ola Kun, Ola Kun, Ola Kun, she is passing your way while pilgrim waves whistle complaints to man. Ola Kun, Ola Kun, Ola Kun, a bearer of roots is walking inside of you. Prepare the morning nets to receive her. Before her peace, I know no thirst because of her. Behind her peace, I know beauty because of her. Under her peace, I know not fear because of her. Over her peace, I am wealthy because of her. Death is coming, 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 death is coming. The whole world hears the buffalo walk of death passing through the archway of new life. The day is singing, he is singing in the mountains. The night is singing, she is in the earth. I am circling new boundaries. I have been trailing the ornamental songs of death, life, a strong pine tree dancing in the wind. I inhale the ancient black breath, cry for every living, dying creature. Come, 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 come. You, you, me, you, me, you, you, me, you, 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 me, me, you, 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 you. Let us ascend from the middle of our breath, sacred rhythms, inhaling peace.
Yeah. Thank you, mm-hmm. Sonia. Well, I guess Sonia Sanchez has just read some of her poems for us. You know, a lot of people really never get interested in either reading poetry or, of course, writing poetry. How mm-hmm. did you first get
started?
Yeah. Or excited by yeah. words and language.
I started to write as a child. As a child, I was a stutterer, and so I used to go and. People are terrible when it comes to stutterers. I mean, even sometimes people in your own family. And no one really wanted to wait. So therefore, I found myself writing. I would write something and hand it to someone as I got older. And then I would find, because of that affinity, that closeness to the paper and the pen or the pencil, I started to write. And I didn't realize I was writing poetry until years later. But I started to, you know, do those usual kinds of ditties. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. But it was great. And I would, like, pass messages and rhyme. Which is interesting. I'm doing a lot of that now in terms of my head, trying to remember some things that I used to do because someone has asked me to do a long biographical piece. And I was kind of trying to retrace those steps. But I remember that I started to do things and people used to laugh and smile. I don't think they kept any of those things because I asked my father recently about it and he said no. But that's how I started. And I didn't, in quotes, do it seriously. I continued to write when we moved to New York. That was in Birmingham, Alabama. I belonged to a club after school, and we kind of like met and would read books and review books. But also a couple of people wrote poetry. And so one day, you know, I stood up and read my poems. When I read my poems, I didn't stutter, however, which was fascinating, too. But in classes around people or whatever you name it, I was really, you know, the stutterer, and people kind of looked, you know, peculiarly at me. But I wrote into college. I was doing some things in college, and I really didn't get the kind of support that I needed. Some of the writing classes there, at least one, and I stopped writing, period. That's why I'm very careful about what I say to would-be writers, and that's why one makes a classroom a place for a nurturing place where you nurture the talent and you help it to grow, and you never, in a sense, in any way, turn the person off or the people off. That's very important. And I didn't start again until I met a man. I started to write again, and I went to NYU. And I noticed that Louis Bogan, the poet, was doing a poetry class. And I said, well, I think I'll go and register, but I'll sit with one foot in the door. Because if she doesn't shape up, I mean, she ends up being a person who gets upset about what I'm writing, boom, I'm gone. But she didn't. And I stayed for the year. And some people in that workshop kind of went around and said, you, you're good. Let's meet in the village. And we met for 3 years in the village until I, you know, finally said, hey, you know, I think I'm ready to cut it loose.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have any formal interests in your poetry?
What do you mean formal interests?
Well, like traditional poetry had meter and a certain sense of rhyme.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. I write, I teach when I teach poetry. I mean, it's interesting. People remember you for the poems they want to remember you for, but people also know that I've written sonnets. You know, I have a whole sonnet sequence to my father, okay? I teach form. I make many of my students write the villanelle. You know, I've done villanelles, I've done sonnets, I've done hakus and tankas. My students have to deal with form because they come to me writing very free-flowing kinds of things. And what I do with them is I give them form. You know, I take them to one of the smallest forms, which is the haku, which is very difficult. It's a very difficult form to master. But what I'm interested in is that I'm interested in them looking at it and getting very, very familiar with words and juxtaposing words, you know, what that means when you're changing around. So when you're dealing with 17 syllables, you know, you got to deal with your words. I mean, you don't have time to go off in left field anyplace. And then after about 3 or 4 weeks of form, I give them freedom again because they've got to understand that freedom involves discipline. Of course, that's what it's all about. Then I bring them back to form, and I've done sonnets. I've done the ballads. I do blues, and I've given the blues, the ballad, the sonnet form, maybe the villanelle at that point, which people say, the villanelle. But then I read them Dylan Thomas's Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night, and then right away they lean back. And then I read them villanelles from other students of mine, and then they can understand the possibilities there. And they come in and say, hey, you know, you talk about discipline, having to do certain things with that form. And so therefore, it makes them really deal with words. The words are so important. And you just don't just choose a word out of the sky. You know, you have got to deal with what those words mean.
Is there a specific process that you have when you decide that a certain thought or a certain subject is going to be a poem.
Yeah, there are many processes. I think like a lot of writers, if I'm home and if I've been working on something, okay, if I've written something down on an envelope, like, you know, sometimes you're driving and something comes to you, you know, and you start repeating it over and over, a line over and over again, or you try to reach for a pencil and you try to write it while you're driving, you know, with one hand. I don't recommend that. or you're, you know, on the subway or whatever, and you see something, you write down lines, and they're not necessarily the poem, but like it's the beginning. I take those lines home, and usually I work at my desk, or at, I have a smaller desk in my bedroom, or in the bed, and I pull all my books. You know, my books on the side, on the left side of me, and I'm on the right side of the bed, and I begin that whole process. And usually, before I begin to write, I always read favorite poets. And I have favorite poems, whatever. And it's like I always tell my students, one of the things we do in the classroom is we talk about the creative process. And they never think that's important. You know, like I'll say when they first bring the first thing to me, I say, you know, talk about it. How did it begin? You know, what did you do? And they say, well, here's the poem. I want to read the poem. And what do you think about it? But finally, they began to realize during the semester that the creative process is part of the poem, you know. And what I do in terms of talking about that is that I Xerox one of my poems from one of my notebooks where I've done the first lines, you know, maybe about I have 20 lines and they're terrible. And then we go on to the revision and it's even worse, you know. So the students kind of look up at me and smile and say, ha ha, look at here. This is lousy, lousy, lousy. But then we get to the third revision, you begin to see a little something happening, and they look up and say, "Whoa, this is still lousy, right?" And by the fourth revision, they look and they begin to see a semblance of a poem developing there, and on, and it might be seven revisions, and then they see the poem, and we go over that, and we talk about it, and I say, "Well, these were the lines, the first lines, and this is what I wrote." But I always tell them, "Never stop the flow. Don't, you know, in a sense, edit as you're trying to get that flow out. Get it all out, regurgitate it out, whatever." And quite often, I say, "This is what I get from you, the first regurgitation. It is not a finished product because all these things, I say, here, look when I started the revision, how I changed this, and look what happened to the poem. It got really corny on many levels."
There's a certain dividing line that I think most people are unsure of, and of course, it's a personal thing between spontaneity and just sloppiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, many people say, I don't want to mess with the greatness of the poem, you know, with this quick outflowing that I've done, because if I mess with it, then it'll lose all that. And that's a lie. You see, and that's something people, you know, perpetrated for a long time. I said, okay, if you wanted to stay on that level, then you can just keep bringing it in and boom, boom, boom. But if you really want, and what happens in the class by midterm, we don't have a midterm, but by the mid-semester, they begin to see. Because when I ask them to do, again, maybe free verse for the first time, they notice a difference in their free verse. You see, they notice a tightening up. You know, an unwillingness to throw a line on just a word on one line just for the hell of it, of a heck of it. Excuse me. You know, what they do is that they move back and they begin to see this word needs to be here. It has no business out there. They also begin to revise old poems as a consequence of that. And the final is a 20 poems, a book, a first book. And it's fascinating sometimes the kinds of things that we get in that classroom.
What's the experience like for you of looking back at poems that you wrote in the late 60s or early 70s, poems that are maybe 10 years old or 8 years, 12 years old?
I read a lot of those poems still. Some of them are, especially in terms of some things happening today all over the world, are very relevant. Some people say sometimes you know that they are dated poems, but it doesn't mean that they're not good. You know, I mean, everything is dated. I mean, I look at some clothes I've had 15 years ago, but it's quite often interesting things. I pull them out and start wearing them again. The same thing with poetry. I think that you and I understand that things go in cycles, you see. And in 5 more years, you'll be pulling some of those old poems out of the closet again and using them again. So I think that if something's written well, you know, it never dies. You know, and I think it's also a record of what was happening, an historical record of what was happening at a certain time. I wouldn't get on the stage and say, I'm black, because people say, hey, look up and say, you know, Terry, you look at me and say, she's black, right? But I got on the stage in the early 60s and said, I'm black, and people say, oh my God, really? You know, isn't that terrible? Because like no one ever talked about the word black, because black was such a, in quotes, a dirty word, you know, here in America, it was a dirty word to call people. So certain things happen at that particular time. There's no sense that you don't have to go back over those things. But poems I did to people like Malcolm, poems I did to Robeson. You know, a lot of people, they're all very relevant kinds of poems. Martin Luther King, whatever. They're very relevant kinds of things.
One of your books from, I think, 1974, Blues Book for...
Blue Black Magical Women.
Yes, uh-huh. Is dedicated to Elijah Muhammad.
That's right.
You were a Muslim, mm-hmm. I believe, at the time you wrote the book.
That's right. In fact, if anyone's interested in the history of the Black movement and Black writers, all you have to do is read Black writers and see the ones who all of a sudden from 64, who began to say Black. That was the influence of Elijah Muhammad. And that's what that book was about. It was like one of those things saying, hey, finally, I'm going to give credit. Because we were saying, you know, in America, they capitalized Negro in the 20s, which meant before that you were just a thing, you know, if you understand Spanish and Negro, what that means. So one gave credit to, like, you know, what credit was due at that particular point. Every so-called radical Black leader. From Cleaver on down, had been influenced by what Elijah Muhammad has said. So it was just like looking up saying thanks. You know, it was also dedicated to my father. It was like looking up saying thanks to my father, too. And in a sense, he was like a spiritual father because he brought, I mean, he made me, you know, realize that I was Black. And that was not to be scared of, you know. He helped me to, like, in a sense, moving in a natural, you know, when I was always, you know, so involved, like getting a comb and straightening it, trying to make it straight, and then not learning how to swim at a certain time because, like, when you got it wet, right, you know, it jumped back, you know, got curly like this, like it is as it is now. And that was something very special because the whole process of slavery in America wiped out all those kinds of things, good things that people felt about themselves, you see, you know, and it was very important, you know, to change that.
What about the more religious aspects mm-hmm. of Muhammad's teachings?
Mm-hmm. What do you mean, more religious?
Were you a very religious person?
I'm a very spiritual person, I think. I think most people who dealt with Elijah Muhammad and the idea of being Black, the idea of Black businesses and whatever, they were not, of course, religious people as much spiritual people. I think Black people are spiritual people. I think there's a need for some spiritual things to happen. And there was indeed, because of him, a sense, an awakening. The real Black consciousness movement came from him. You know, and that's what we're talking about at this particular point. So I think that I'm not a spiritual person in the sense that, I'm not to offend people. I just don't. I think that quite often many people saw that organization as more political than religious. And that's a very real, you know, interpretation of it, because they saw it moving politically and you accepted some of the things that went along, you see. But the point is that, like, there was another movement, you know, completely, you know, a different kind of movement happening at the same time. So from Baraka to Cleaver to Huey, all these people came in and out of the mosque, you know, and they listened, they read, and the things that they threw out, they regurgitated out from Malcolm on, you know, this is all of that happened. It's a fantastic kind of movement.
It's interesting to see what happened, because mm-hmm. Baraka is now an ardent Marxist, I think.
Oh, yes, yes.
And Cleaver is a born-again Christian.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. you're no longer a Muslim.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
How come you left?
I don't think that anyone can answer why they leave. I think, like anything else, like Malcolm, you know, one moves on to other kinds of things. You know, if people aren't continuing in terms of politics, whatever, you move on because, like, the world changes within a given time. I think that within a given time and within the Black community, that played a very important role. It sustained people, you know, it showed a consciousness. But you move past consciousness. I mean, you move to other kinds of things and perhaps many more political kinds of things. So I think lots of people, you know, began to study different kinds of things. I met, as I said, Shirley Graham Du Bois, and we had, you know, distinct talks about the world and whatever. And many things happened. So, you know, I moved on.
Mm-hmm. There are many mm-hmm. Black people in Philadelphia who are Muslims now. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a number of women mm-hmm. who are Muslims wearing veils that cover their entire bodies, including
I've seen
all their
them
faces.
Too. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, I haven't spoken mm-hmm. to any of the women, no women mm-hmm. who I know directly mm-hmm. wear those veils, but I always find myself wondering why they wear them, because it always makes me a little nervous that someone mm-hmm. would feel about their body in such a way that they would cover it and hide themselves.
Well, I'm not made nervous by it. I look up. My children look up, and I think a lot of people look up. Sometimes you find people, you know, giving funny looks, whatever. But, I mean, in terms of cultural kinds of things, I mean, I'm not disturbed by it or whatever, because I think that sometimes perhaps the difference in terms of Western culture and other kinds of cultures, we assume that if our body has free movement, then we are freer. you know, than when our body is covered, then we are less liberated. And so I think it's a value judgment, probably. You know, I just look, and sometimes they smile, and you smile back, and you keep going, you know. And I think as long as people are feel good about what they're doing, then, like, we are, in a sense, to, you know, to leave and to watch and to let them be.
Mm-hmm. Sonia, have you ever mm-hmm. become involved with feminism at all?
I've been, I've done some work for Black Feminists in Chicago, an organization. I've been on many panel discussions about, in quotes, feminism, whatever. And as many people say, I write in some of my work is, in quotes, called feminist poetry. I have a lot of things about women. I've always pushed, in quotes, women. And that's probably a lot of my difficulty in any movement I've been in, because, you know, there has always been, in America, there is sexism, you know, and so there's chauvinism. And of course, even among Blacks, we would have some of the same kinds of things happening. And so, even when I would get up to speak, to read my poetry, sometimes some of the men got ready to leave. You know, they'd leave, boom. And I turned one day and said, hey, look, you know, what I'm saying is equally as important as what you just said, so I think you should stay. People say, oh, that's Sonia. You know, she's, you know, she has a big mouth, whatever. That was fine. But the point is that what I was saying is that, like, it was not just restricted to women, you know, and it was equally as important as what, you know, what the men had said. I've always been outspoken. It's gotten me into a lot of trouble sometimes, but I've never relegated myself to walk behind anyone. And I think that many women who have been in the movement have not done that. Many women who have been political in this country have gone out on stages. And I think that, like, a lot of us, when I was in San Francisco with Black Studies, many of the Black women were doing that in a very early time, in the early 60s, whatever, coming out of the civil rights movement, whatever. And I think we influenced a lot. I mean, I saw the white women's liberation movement being born. I saw it, and I was asked to come and speak to some of the women. And what they did is they said, if you can do it, we can do it too. And that was very important. And I felt an affinity. I said very frankly, I don't feel an affinity if you don't understand some of the problems that third world women are experiencing. And they're very real kinds of problems. And I think that, like, it should not be an upper class or middle class, you know, movement. We are talking about women, you know, who need to change, who need to come out under oppression, just like we're talking about Blacks who need to, and other third world people who need to come up out under oppression. And I think that, like, there are points where people can meet, certainly, you know, and move and work accordingly. But I think also that, many things have got to be discussed. So yes, I've done many many of my poems have been in what we call feminist journals, books of poetry written edited by women and for women, because, like, I have a lot of what we call women's themes, and I think they affect they move, they touch women, period, you see. We all have these kinds of poems because we are indeed, as women, we have all experienced some of the same pain. You know, and it has, in quotes, no, in quotes, color on them at all.
Mm-hmm. I've met some Black women who really think that feminism has nothing to do with Black women, mm-hmm. and that the ideas of that really wouldn't work in the Black community.
Well, I think because we have not really defined what we're talking about when we talk about feminism or women's liberation or what they're all about, you see. I think that's probably the problem. And I think also many, perhaps, and I don't want to speak for everyone, okay, perhaps speaking maybe from just Sonia, that looking at it, that and discussing with some students, perhaps some people have thought that it was a replacement for the movement as such, you know, the thrust towards, and when we had something called affirmative action, that was settled by hiring women as opposed to Blacks, you see, whereas it was supposed to have been Blacks and women, etc. So I can see some dis-ease, you know, unease, some problems with it, most certainly. And I think that this country has sometimes opted the easy way when this country talks about affirmative action. It says, well, I have a woman here. I have three women, you know, and, you know, what's your particular problem, period. I think we're talking about perhaps the reason why feminism has arisen, the reason why there are women who are talking in a assertive way, that we have had women who have been oppressed, you know, all over the world, and there's a history of it. There's a long history of it, you know, going back you know, into our, you know, very in European history, you know, all the way from first night rights or lords, you know, with black women into slavery here, you know, and then back in terms of Africa, whatever. I mean, it's very real. So therefore, I don't think you can, in a sense, ignore it. I think more than likely we've got to deal with it. Perhaps if we give an historical approach to it, analyze it accordingly, then we can understand what's happening today. I think some women move away from feminism because they see it as homosexuality, too. Don't forget. I mean, like, a lot of that does, I mean, this is how they move. So a lot of women were threatened by this kind of movement. And I'm saying, again, we've got to be very careful about what we mean. I mean, I was on a panel with someone who said, you know, she equated the two as one. But some women don't see that, you know.
Equated what?
Feminism with lesbianism.
Oh, well.
You see. Yeah, but I'm saying, when you have someone who's going to say that, you know, then you have women who will move away very fast and say, hey, no way. And I don't know if that's done on purpose sometimes or not, to destroy that kind of motion and movement. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, you know what I have trouble understanding, though? And this gets back to something that we touched on a little before. Mm-hmm. Like, historically, I would tend to think of, like, veiling one's face as being...
But I don't know. I never veiled my face, and I never, you know, so it's very difficult for me to speak to that, you know.
There's some things that I just can't make sense of, and I can't tell what's cultural projection and what's an almost.
Except if people have a history of something, you know, we've got to understand the problem. They've got to move out or in or whatever, you know, at their own rate and pace, period. If we've never had a history of that here, you know, whatever. But yet in all... you know, they are, you know, peculiar things that have happened here. I mean, when I first got a natural, people thought that was the pure madness. Just driving here, I stopped at a light. A guy was in a truck over me. He says to his partner, look at there. And so I looked up to see, you know, I looked over there to see and looked up and realized they were looking at me. He said, look at there. Look at all that hair. And so I looked up at him and said, imagine that. And looked back on the road. You know, I didn't look at him and say, ooh, look at you. You know, you have a bald head, which is what he had, you see.
Now, I still hear commercials all the time on television for hair relaxers is what they're called
now. Oh, sure, sure. It's very real. And it's very real because this country, you know, says in very interesting kinds of ways that, you know, you should identify not with yourself how you look, you know, what that's all about, but like straighten it, relax it so you can sling it back and whatever. I mean, there are many blacks with straight hair. You know, whatever. And they can sling it back if they want to. But the point is that I'm just utterly amazed. And I hadn't heard that or seen that in years. And I don't know if that's indicative of Philadelphia or what. But it was just like I happened just to look up, you know, and boom. Because I thought something was happening. But it was just, I don't know if this is just a recent upsurge of things or whatever. But I just think that, I didn't have any bones in my noses and whatever, you know. But on the other hand, if I were covered up, you know, he wouldn't even see it, so he would even be annoyed, huh?
Do you feel a strong connection to the students who you work with now, and do your politics coincide in many ways now? Because it's
well, the classroom is a classroom, and the classrooms when I'm teaching poetry, I teach poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I've always taught poetry. I teach you how to write. If I'm teaching a short story, I teach you how to write a decent short story, you know, well-constructed short story or well-constructed play. I would teach, if I'm doing a playwriting, crafted playwriting, you know, we do Brecht, you know, and his politics speaks for, you know, we'll speak, you know, whatever. You know, we do Beckett, you know, I'll do Baraka, whatever, and I choose the plays because I think that students should be exposed to many kinds of plays. And then we'll do Antigone, a section from Antigone, because there's something that I want to show and turn to developing a dialogue, et cetera. You know, what we're talking about is that, you know, that that we as teachers have a commitment to students, and we have a commitment to teach them all that we know, and we have a commitment to come to bring them out at a different point. They come in at a point, and we bring them to another point, and we leave them there was for someone else to take to another point. But you and I know that the classroom is political. That's why I'm always utterly amazed by questions like that. I mean, either the classroom perpetuates the status quo, you know, or perhaps it talks about, gives variety, alternatives. So in my classroom, I've always given alternatives. You know, I've given a variety of writers. You know also that's why Black Studies began here in this country. Because students were going into something called American Lit and never read a Black writer. That's impossible. Or a Chinese writer. Chinese-American writer, whatever. And so Black Studies was begun on that premise, on that level. There are Puerto Rican writers writing, whatever. And they have a long history of writing. There are Black writers in this country that go all the way back, you know, to Phyllis Wheatley and whatever. And that's what that was about. So, of course, when I do a course for Women's Studies called Women in Lit, you know, there is an integration, you know, of different kinds of writers. If I do a course called African, you know, women writers, you know, then again, we have all these women. And it's not enough time for me to really study and to teach from Alice Walker to Toni Morrison to all the other writers, etc. I mean, it's just not enough. So I'm saying that what we've done is we've tried to correct that non-balance that has existed here in this country. And because we tried to correct it, people have said it's political. You know.
So no, I really regret to say we're out of time now. Right. I hope that sometime in the near future you could come back and talk with us some more and do another reading.
Sure.
I've been with Sonia Sanchez, and I'd like to say if you'd like to hear her read in person, she's going to be next week reading at the Afro-American Historical and Cultural Museum. This is going to be in a program in honor of the late Martin Luther King. The program will be on January 15th. It's going to begin at 8:00. And there will also be some music accompaniment for the reading.
I think so, for some of them, right. Mm-hmm.
And also reading will be Everett Hoagland, Ricky Leitz, and Naomi Nelson. If you want to come, you should really make a reservation. So let me give you the phone number. If you can get out a pencil, it's 574-3696. 574-3696, and the program's at the Afro-American Historical and Cultural Museum. Sonia, I wish you the best. You have a new book that's about to come out, just come out.
Yes, it's called A Sound Investment in Other Stories. They're short stories for junior high school students, elementary school, and high school, and for you and me.
Maybe you could come oldies. And read them sometime.
I'd love to, because I have some fantastic, like I do a fable, How Rain Was Made, and it's just very gentle. And I always try it out. I have twins, so I always try it out on my children, of course, before I even do anything. Right. I said, do you like that?
Okay, well, I look forward to seeing you soon. Thanks for coming today. Okay. This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.
Thank you.
was Jelly Roll Morton, a composition of his own called The Crave. This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 7 minutes to 3 o'clock. At about 3:30 this afternoon, our film reviewer, Bill Van Wert, will be with us, and today he's going to talk about the film The Electric Horseman. The United States in a Revolutionary World is the theme for a lecture series sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Wilmington and the University of Delaware in Newark, Delaware. Last night, as part of this series, Dr. Howard Perlmutter of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania gave an address on U.S. transnational corporations in a revolutionary world. In his address, Dr. Perlmutter discussed the changes and difficulties transnational corporations will encounter in the next 10 years in a world of nations asserting their own national interests. In a moment, we're going to hear this talk, which was recorded for Fresh Air by WUHY's Pete Simon. Howard Perlmutter is a professor of social architecture at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. In recent years, he's directed a major research project which compared the relationship of multinational companies and national governments in the United States and Europe. His most recent book, published last year, is called The Multinational Organization Development, A Social Architectural Perspective. He's currently directing a project on the future of private, mixed, and government-controlled transnational corporations in the world economy. He's been an advisor to over 100 transnational corporations and 7 governments on global strategy and organizational development. Dr. Perlmutter's academic background includes training in mechanical engineering and psychology. We're going to hear now the talk that he gave last night at the University of Wilmington.
It's a pleasure to sit back, I hope you will, and take a look at what we have before us in the 1980s. I will take a time perspective of the future of international companies in a world that we think will evolve over the next 10 years that will be so different from today that it will take a certain degree of anticipation of the changes in reading through daily events to even understand the dramatic character of this change. The term transformation means it's different enough in form that it really looks, in some basic way, absolutely new. But there is a feature of this world I'd like to talk about, and the transnational corporations that acts as a consistent background to understanding world events and to companies. This is described as a world where surprise is normal, where people may predict, but what they predict is historically best forgotten after they've done it, where change is rapid and unexpected, and there are new sources of change you never thought would be important. 60 students outside an Iranian embassy, American embassy in Iran. The ground is in motion. What used to be stable becomes unstable. There are rapid feedbacks between political things and economic things and technological change from one part of the world to the other. And there are decision makers who become pretty concerned about the change and push what we call panic buttons from time to time, thus creating a whole new set of events. It is a world where little things can become big. Emergent processes become dramatically important in relatively short periods of time. I remember giving some boring lectures 10 years ago on pollution, a problem for the future, and watching my sleeping audience. I gave it up because I didn't think there was much to it, but I must say things have changed. Now people think concern with consequences of things are really much more important. If you recall 10 years ago, it was results. Results were more important than consequences. but these have shifted in a relatively short period of time. The structure of the world is of higher degrees of interdependence. That is, people seem to depend more on what is happening in other countries by other groups, and that some of these interdependencies are based upon unstable relationships where some people have more power. They're unbalanced interdependencies. I should say, interdependence is not a nice word for most of the world, because they say, what do you mean by interdependent? I mean, who's really dependent on whom? If we're interdependent with the oil company, oil countries, we don't like it. We're going to be self-reliant. We don't want to be dependent. And interdependent, say the developing countries, is just a screen for dependence. And yet, the reality is, it's difficult to construct a country which does not have economic, social, political, cultural, informational linkages with other countries. It's the nature of those linkages that constitute the issues. I'm really saying that the world I'm calling turbulent is a world where there are high degrees of uncertainty about the consequences of being interdependent between countries. And it's not pleasant interdependence, not a world that people have described as a friendly global village. It's where we don't really enjoy the degree of connection between our inflation rate and some other country, because it means our country can't control, nor can other countries control, by national action what's happening outside the system or their organizations. And if that's the way the future is, then we have essentially a new set of ground rules to live and learn about. Our map of the world is wrong, the one I learned as a child, where you have Canada to the north and Mexico to the south. I think it's a... I've tried in visual terms to draw the map every day I read the newspaper of saying which country is near us today. It may be 10,000 miles on the map, but Iran's been awfully close for the past 67 or 8 days. It's like it's really close. Matter of fact, I can get pictures of it from time to time if you get the pictures. So that kind of interdependence, in the sense that things can happen a long distance away geographically but close, that becomes a concept of neighboringness not related to geography and contagion that is, I think, a ground rule for living in the 80s. But when you think of the consequences of that, you now have to say, well, how do we live in this kind of chaos or surprise? Now, the human mind can't cope really for long periods of time by saying everything is a surprise, and who knows what's going to happen tomorrow. It can be the Ayatollah suddenly becomes a Baptist, or you know, some things won't happen quite like that. So we have certain predictions we don't expect that have any merit. But as we look at the turbulence, we look at the uncertainty, we begin, and you have to look hard sometimes, to see patterns emerging from the chaos. And what I'd like to suggest to you as I talk about the transformation of the transnational is there are some patterns in the chaos, in the uncertainty. And my hypothesis is these patterns are just beginning to show as different ways of viewing the world or ways of thinking about how our world should be organized. And I'm going to talk about these patterns in two ways. First, there are about 9 or 10 changes we see today that are very likely to be permanent as far as the 80s are concerned. See, that's already a little information. If you're not going to change every week, at least we know there's a direction to change. I'll call them structural changes, because it's hard to see how things are going to change that much on these score. And the interesting thing is, I go around the world and say that pretty much got the same list from different people around the world. So at least they all are telling each other the same stories, but I don't know if it's right or not. So I'll read you those very shortly. The second, I'll sort of say, beneath these factors in which transnationals, whatever they will call them in a few moments, are two opposing ideas about the world of the future that are in conflict and not really compatible for the moment. Now, the first one is the world in the 1980s is a world of multiple sources of power, a multipolar world. U.S., Soviet Union, important, Chinese, Western Europe, Japan, other centers of power in developing countries. And the struggle and the no country can organize this system, or two countries, as a set of affiliate countries or client countries. And for the United States, it means a recognition that as a country, we're in a, and it's a difficult one, even though it may not be help, we are a country in a world where not only politically our power has to be limited under some circumstances, although different presidential candidates will give different theories about what could be done to remedy it, not in detail, I note, just in general. But I understand the concern about not feeling as powerful as we are and trying to remedy it. But in economic and technological terms, it does, we think, indicate a trend which is fairly difficult to reverse. For example, in research and development, if you can count these things, maybe it was 50% of the research and development of the world was done in the United States 10 years ago. We think it's about 20% today. Now, when you have information being created in proportions in some areas, some changes, now it varies by industry, but that's a trend over time. Also, as a proportion of the world's wealth, less is created in America, as you would expect. Not because we failed as an economy. It's because other economies have learned to do some things we, as Americans, could do, such as make computers, make automobiles, make television sets which people want to look at, and so forth. It's not a deficiency of America. It's just that some of these traits are producible by other human beings. The second problem of the 80s is stagflation. That is, we do have this extraordinary phenomenon that economists may try to explain, or certainly write about frequently, of how we can have rising prices and not rapid growth. In fact, in some industries, not very much growth at all. And we probably have some big industries in which we have invested part of the economy that in world terms, or at least in US terms, are not going to grow very much in the 80s. Like automobiles. Now, stagflation, stagnation plus inflation, and rising debt and monetary instability are problems in economic terms, which every new presidential candidate will come in and say he will solve if he were president. But they won't do it that quickly. I do not believe they are, given the factors, they are the kinds of things one wipes away with grim determination and a little self-discipline. But they are structural problems for most countries in the 1980s. The third point is that the world is a broad term, but more people believe more things are due to them, not because they are needs, but because they are rights. And we have what are called rising entitlements. It's okay if you have a need to have food or a need to have health because you say, well, we all have needs. We sure wish you well. But when you have a right to have it, then the obligation of government or some powers is to make sure that all persons get it. And we have a larger number of rights and groups who want rights today than 10 years before, and we will have more in the future. Whether they will get what they want is another story. The ideology behind this is something called egalitarianism, which is people are people. I mean, and they have certain, because they're human and they're born on this earth, they deserve certain amounts of things. We have 15.6 million children die every year in this world, between 0 and 5, and 15.3 could be saved. They could be saved not by fancy technology, but by if they were immunized, if the water they drank, particularly during the weaning periods, the food they had, would be clean, and they had some good basic nutrition. It wouldn't have to be fancy stuff. But not much, that would do quite a lot. That'd be a pretty, say about 15 million or so. By the way, for those of you who worry about population, if the first two children live, the average family size is 2.8 smaller than if the first two children die. There's a little calculus despite literacy or illiteracy that if half your children are going to die, you'll have twice as many because they're going to take care of you when you're older. So the WHO discovered these extraordinary figures one day and couldn't believe it. They said, how could they know that? I mean, do they count? And yes, they do. I mean, most people do when they wonder how many children they should have. But we do have a world where not only there are rising entitlements, but more people feel they are not getting in their lifetime or 10 lifetimes what they will have. And these needs will grow. They will not go away and saying, well, we'll forget it for two generations. The fourth point I'd like to make is that more parts of society, more pieces, more parts of a country begin to say, do I have as much as the other?